Matthew 5, verses 21 through 37. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of sexual immorality makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
Often on preaching weeks, I get a text or an email from a friend that may say something like, hey, I'm excited to hear you preach this week, or praying for you, or looks good, Rich, you know, whatever. But this week I had a lot of texts and emails and even people stopping by, often with the Bible open to the passage going, you got to preach on this? These verses that Doug just read are difficult verses to consume and to hear. These verses have created a mix of emotions in people's hearts and lives, even now this morning, maybe as they were read. These verses are powerful, convicting, maybe disheartening. These verses are possibly confusing. Some have used the word terrifying, even offensive. As I prepared for this sermon, I came across an article by an author and a professor, and she was working at the time at the University of Texas A&M, and she decided in her literature class to have her students read the Sermon on the Mount. And what she discovered in this is that most of her students, in fact, she thought all but one or two of them, had never actually encountered the Sermon on the Mount before. That as they read through it, it was the first time they had ever heard these words of Jesus. And she was surprised by the response and the reaction that the students wrote. In fact, she was so surprised, she wrote a whole journal article and published it because she thought others needed to hear. In this article that I came across, she quotes students and some of the things that these college students said as they heard the Sermon on the Mount or read the Sermon on the Mount for the first time were as follows. One student said, "There is an old saying that you shouldn't believe everything you read. It applies in this case." Another student wrote, "I did not like the essay Sermon on the Mount. It was hard to read and made me feel like I had to be perfect, and no one is." Another student wrote, "The things asked in this sermon are absurd. To look at a woman is adultery? That is the most extreme, stupid, unhuman statement that I have ever heard." Virginia Owens, the professor, went on to summarize all the responses as follows. And I put this one up on the screen because this quote's a little longer. "So what do I make of these responses? First of all, I now understand why, in literature classes, one has to explain the simplest biblical allusions, even references to Jonah and the whale or Noah and the ark. Beyond that, however, I find it strangely heartening that except for the young man who found the Sermon on the Mount a guide to good manners, the Bible remains offensive to honest, ignorant ears, just as it was in the first century. For me, that somehow validates its significance. Whereas the scriptures almost lost their characteristically astringent flavor during the past century, the current widespread biblical illiteracy should catapult us into a situation more nearly approximating that of their original first century audience." Professor Owen's line that really stuck out to me: "The Bible remains offensive to honest, ignorant ears, just as it was in the first century." I would like to dive into the Sermon on the Mount and this section of it today and find out what it is that Jesus is saying that can come across as offensive and terrifying and confusing and powerful and convicting. But before we jump in together, I just want to point out a structure that we'll encounter throughout this passage. We're going to look at these four sections here in the verses that Doug read, and each one begins with a saying, "You have heard that it was said," and then Jesus follows up with, "But I say." So we're going to find that throughout this passage. "You have heard that it was said, but I say." It was commonplace in Jesus' time that the community would gather in the synagogue and that the rabbi or the Pharisee or the leader would go up to the wall and grab a giant scroll on which the Torah or the law or the scripture, the Old Testament, was written on. And they would open up that giant scroll and read aloud. And after they had read that aloud, they would interpret the law. They would expand upon what did this passage mean. And so Jesus is saying, "You have heard your teachers and leaders read from the law. You've heard it read out loud. You've heard it interpreted to you." But Jesus says, "But this is what I say." Jesus, the creator of the universe, the second in the triune God, the one who wrote the law, Jesus, the one whose character is embedded in the law, wishes to say, "You've heard it said, but let me say." It should open our ears to listen. John Stott, an English theologian, writes this. He says, "What the scribes and Pharisees were doing in order to make obedience more readily attainable was to restrict the commandments and extend the permissions of the law. They made the law's demands less demanding and the law's permission more permissive. What Jesus did was to reverse both tendencies. He insisted that the full interpretation of God's commandments must be accepted without imposing any artificial limits. And God's permissions must be accepted and not arbitrarily increased. So what is it that Jesus is saying? What is it that he is communicating? How is he interpreting the law? The first thing that Jesus says is anger kills. Read with me. We're going to start in verse 21 of chapter 5. Again, it's found on page 810 in the Bibles provided for you, or look on your phone or tablet, whatever works easiest. We're in Matthew chapter 5, verse 21, and Jesus begins. And he says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder.' And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." I think if we stopped after the first phrase that Jesus says, we'd all get it, that murder is bad. I don't think there's anyone that walks around and goes, no, I think murder's a great idea. We all naturally get it. Murder is not good. Murder hurts. Murder destroys. But Jesus says, hey, there's more to it than that. See, Jesus uses an interesting word. He says, whoever calls anyone a fool is liable to the fires of hell. This word is an interesting word. The word is raka. And it's not an insult that would have been used on the streets of the day. In fact, it really just means nothing. Literally, the word means nothing. Empty. Non-entity. So Jesus is saying, if you walk around and say things to people, then say, you are nothing, you are meaningless, you're about this big in my mind, that's the root that leads a murderer to murder. And that as we walk around, we do this in our lives, that we look at people with such disdain and contempt that we say things to them and look at them in a way that says, you mean nothing to me. You are worth nothing. Jesus says that this kills. Now, obviously, we all woke up Monday morning to the news of another horrible tragedy. A man that broke out the windows in his 32nd floor of a hotel and unleashed a barrage of bullets on 22,000 individuals that were at a concert. Dozens killed, hundreds wounded. And all of us started asking the same question: how could somebody think like this? What is the motive that makes somebody do this? It's the question still in the news today. Why? Jesus asks us to consider that. Because as we ask questions, we wonder, what is it about a man that he can do that and think that none of these people's lives matter, that they are so insignificant or meaningless that he can kill them? And yet Jesus says, you feel that way in your heart too sometimes. That you show disdain and contempt with your words and your actions and even the look on your face. And it kills people. Last Sunday, I wasn't here. I was at the beach. I love the beach. And my wife's family all gathered at the beach. It was my in-laws' 70th birthday, both of them, and also their 45th wedding anniversary. It was a great celebration. Susie's brothers and their families flew in from Boston. We had a blast. And whenever we're at the beach, I love to go fishing. There's something powerful about standing in the surf and looking out at the horizon and casting that weight into the water and pulling out a fish. And so I was fishing, and the fishing was great. We were pulling in bluefish and speckled trout every other cast, and they were only about this big, but it was so much fun. The water just seemed to be dancing with fish, and Hudson, my 12-year-old, was getting really excited, and he made his way into town. He walked to the local bait and tackle shop, and he bought himself his own surf pole, and he came back, and he said, "Dad, will you help put this together?" And we put on the tackle and the hooks and the weight, a good 4-ounce weight, because the water was really churning that day, and we got the bait set. We cut up the finger mullet and hooked it to his hooks, and I handed him the pole, and you could just feel the electricity inside of him, his excitement. He was so eager to cast that into the water, to feel the waves on his legs, and to pull out a bluefish that was gonna just make his day. So I got his rod together and I handed him that pole and I turned and started to get mine together. I put on the tackle and the hooks and the weight and cut up some more mullet and attached it to the hooks. And as I turned around to head to the water myself, there was Hudson. And there was a look in his eyes that wasn't right. And he was just sort of holding his rod. And I could see the line had snapped. The tackle was gone. The weight was gone. The hooks were gone. And in that moment, I was thinking in my head, why did he do this? I just want to fish. And now I got to string up his rod again. And before I could stop the words from coming out of my mouth, I just said, "Hudson, how did you let that happen?" And as soon as I said it, his shoulders sank and his eyes welled up with tears, and I knew that I had destroyed all the excitement that he had. And I tried desperately in the moment to fix it, right? "Hudson, it's okay, I'm sorry, it was probably my knot that broke, or maybe you had a giant fish on the line and it snapped your 30-pound test. We'll hook it up again and we'll get bait on it, and it's okay." But the words had already come out of my mouth and they stabbed like a knife and I could see it deflate him. We do that because anger kills. It's why right after these verses, Jesus says, if you're on the way to temple to bring your sacrifice and you realize that you've done something against somebody else, drop what you're doing and head there right away and make it right. You know, it's interesting to me, he doesn't say if you're on the way to the temple with your sacrifice, if you realize somebody has wronged you. No, he goes a step further. He goes, if you realized you have wronged somebody else, they may not even know it. But drop what you're doing and get there, because anger and insults and contempt and disdain, they kill relationships, they kill community. Anger kills. And Jesus says, you gotta fix it. You gotta go make it right. You gotta go to people and say, "I am sorry." And I grabbed Hudson even that evening and sat down and said, "Hudson, Dad can be an idiot sometimes. And I'm sorry I said that. It really probably was my knot that was bad in the fishing line. And I'm sorry I said that." Anger kills. But Jesus doesn't just stop there. He continues. And he says in verse 27 and 28, I think is what he's getting at, is love is not a consumer product. Let's read these verses together and we'll talk about that. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. We live in an incredibly consumer-driven society, right? We always want what's next, what's best, what's faster, what's sleeker, what's smarter. I mean, when I heard that the new iPhone has 3D facial technology, I thought, who really needs that? But we want it. We want what's best. We want what's next. And the companies know it. And so they market to us. And they tell us we have to have it. And we eat it up and we go for it. And Jesus is saying, you're taking that consumer attitude, that attitude that says, how am I going to like this? How is this going to work for me, right? We all do it in the Verizon store trying the different phones. Is this one best for me? Ooh, I like this one. This one's best for me. And Jesus says you're taking that attitude to a relationship that should not be a consumer relationship, but should be a covenant relationship. You're taking this attitude about consumer realities and you're looking at sex and love and marriage and those relationships in the same way. and you're going, how can I get something good out of this? And Jesus says that's a consumer relationship. But a covenant relationship says, how can I change so that my spouse, that my spouse's needs can be met? How can I be different to love my wife? Jesus says, you guys have it all wrong. You're asking yourself the question, how can it be better for me? How can it be nicer for me? How can it be more exciting for me? And that consumer-driven reality leads us to all sorts of things that were not in God's design. And Jesus says that love and sex is designed for the covenant of marriage, a covenant relationship, a relationship that is the place where we can truly be honest and vulnerable. Because even as I was at a wedding yesterday, the vows say for better or for worse, for richer, for poorer, for sickness and in health. And in that relationship, the vulnerability of a romantic relationship makes sense. But outside of it, it loses its integrity. And when we try to separate love and sex and make it into a consumer product, it corrupts our covenant relationships. It's why Jesus gets so dramatic in these next verses, right? He writes things or he says things that seem crazy. He goes, if your eye causes you to sin, throw it away. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Same with your foot. Now, Jesus is not saying that we need to go around and mutilate our bodies, but he's saying if there are things in your life that are leading you to destroy the covenant relationship of marriage, then cut them out. Pluck them off. If that cable subscription or that internet in your house is leading you to make choices, pluck that cable out of the back of the TV. Cut off that subscription. If there's a relationship in your life that you find you're leaning on instead of your spouse, Jesus says, cut that relationship off. Because as soon as love becomes a consumer product, it destroys our covenant relationships. It's why he'll continue, and the next thing I believe he'll say in verses 31 and 32 is that divorce is just too easy. That if we're just shopping around for what's next, what's best, what's better, that's not what God intended. See, in Jesus' day, it was actually really easy to get a divorce. That most of the rabbis that were teaching in the day were simply saying, you can go get a divorce as long as you provide a certificate of divorce. And you didn't have to have a good reason. You don't like their cooking? Divorce them. They mixed the darks and whites in the washing machine, and your white tunic turned pink because it was washed with a red scarf. Divorce them. It was so easy, and Jesus is saying, that's not my design. It's just too easy, and it shouldn't be. Because love is not a consumer product. And marriage is a covenant relationship. And you both need to be working into that relationship the best that you can. To be asking yourself, how can I change to make my spouse's life better? Now, clearly, Jesus leaves room for divorce, instances of infidelity and abuse. And there are lots of other teachings in Scripture about divorce, and I don't want this sermon to become about divorce, but I just want to say, I think the main point here that Jesus is making is divorce is just too easy. He goes on, and I believe his next section, Jesus says, words matter. Let's read together in verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Trust me, I've tried. It doesn't work. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. See, something was happening in that day. There was case law developed around the biblical law that we do as kids on a playground. I don't know if you can take yourself back to when you were 7 or 8 and think about conversations you had with your friends on the playground, but there were things that you would add to statements you would make to help your friends know that you were really telling the truth, right? Does this one make sense? Cross my heart and hope to die. Stick a needle in my eye. That's what we used to say. And if we said that, then we were pretty serious, right? Like, let me borrow your soccer ball. I'll give it back. Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. And then we kick it into the neighbor's yard and never find it again. Or we'd say things like, no crossies, right? Because people would make oaths, but they'd have their hands in their pockets. We'd want to make sure they didn't have their fingers crossed. Or some people get fancy and cross their legs. No crossies, but their legs were crossed. One girl told me her hair was braided, so that made it crossies. Never counted. The one that was really amazing to me, and I can't believe as a 7 or 8 year old we said things like that. I swear on my mother's grave. Where did I even come up with thinking things like that? Literally, I was saying, I'll do this, I promise. If I don't, you can kill my mom. I mean, these are crazy things that we say, and as kids, we laugh about it, but the truth is we do this as adults, too. We make statements that we know, I don't really mean that. And the Pharisees were doing the same thing. You see, they had a whole case law developed around how to take an oath or a vow and how serious it was or wasn't, and it was based off God's presence. You see, if you remember the temple structure, in the middle of the temple, there was a special spot called the Holy of Holies, and that's where God's presence was. And the Pharisees knew that if you invoked God's presence into an oath or a vow, then it was very serious. So if you said, I swear on the presence of God, or I swear on the Holy of Holies, like that was the biggest promise you could make. And if you broke it, you were going to die. But if you swore on something that was 10 feet from the Holy of Holies, say this gold statue over here, if you swore on that item, well, the vow wasn't quite as serious. And if you swore on the altar that was way over here, well, now your vow really didn't mean much at all. And if you broke it, it was no big deal. And so they had a whole system just like we did in the playground based off God's presence. But Jesus is saying, you know what? Your yes can be yes and your no can be no because I'm not confined to a little holy of holies. Jesus is saying, my presence is with you all the time. That I am your audience no matter where you are and who you're talking to. And so let your yes be yes and your no be no because my presence isn't 100 miles away. It's with you. It's why our yes can be yes and our no can be no. And I'd like to use a math analogy right now. But after the first service, I had a math professor come up to me and said, I totally botched this. Then they explained to me what I should have said, and I still don't get it. So I'm just going to say this. I was doing my homework with Wyatt, or his homework. I wasn't doing his homework. I was helping Wyatt. I was sitting next to my son as he did his homework. He's in third grade, and he was looking at numbers and integers and fractions. And to me, an integer is a whole number, but apparently that's not quite right to say that. But I was just thinking there's whole numbers and there's fractions, right? And we get this idea of integrity or integer from this concept of being whole. And I was just thinking through a life of whether we're whole or whether we're living a life of fraction, right? Whether we're living a life of integrity or living a life of fraction. And so I was just thinking through how, depending on the audience, we say different things. We may hang out with our friend Doug and go, Doug, you're my favorite. I like you so much. This is so much fun. I don't like Travis at all. Yeah, this is great. And then we go hang out with Travis and we say, hey, Travis, you're my favorite. Doug, he's crazy. I know. Isn't that crazy? And all of a sudden, we're saying different things in different places. Our life is fractured. And Jesus says, no, your life needs to be integrated. It needs to be whole. It needs to be one. You need to have integrity. That what you say here with Doug better match what you say here with Travis. Because you're no closer or farther to God's presence in any of those scenarios. I am with you no matter what. We do this. How we sell ourselves online or make ourselves to be online is very different than who we are in person. Maybe our resumes as we look for jobs, we beef up some of the stats a little bit to make ourselves look good. Depending on the audience we're with, we sell ourselves in different ways. I always say that as a youngest child, I needed to get some words in at the dinner table, so I would tell extraordinary stories. And every fish I did catch was this big, even though they were this big. Jesus says that lacks integrity. That even little white lies and exaggerations, they all break up trust. They all break relationships. They all break community. And I didn't say this in the first service, but I just thought of it now. I remember teaching a Sunday school class once in college, and we talked about the belt of truth, because when you don't tell the truth, you get caught with your pants down. That wasn't inappropriate, was it? But that idea that if you're not telling the truth all the time, eventually it catches up to you. And Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no, because I'm standing right next to you anyway. And there's an integrity that builds community versus lies that tear it apart. So Jesus says, anger kills. He says love is not a consumer product. He says divorce is too easy. He reminds us that our words matter. And now we have to respond. What will our response be? Every now and then we have movie night in our house. It's an exhausting week maybe. Susie's been working, I've been working, the kids have been school, and so we just need to get some takeout food and put a movie on the TV and just veg out and relax together. But I will say, finding a movie that works for the family can be a difficult task. You know, I've got my six-year-old in the room, and I'm 41, and we have different tastes and interests, actually, and so we're trying to figure out what movie works, and you're scrolling through Netflix going, nope, seen that. How about this one? No, you don't like it? Okay, we'll move to the next one. It's a really difficult task, actually. Drives me nuts. So I thought, it's a great idea. Why don't we just start showing movies from our childhood? You know, the movies that we watched over and over again. I could think through our little piece of furniture in my house growing up with all my VHS cassette tapes with movies like Harry and the Hendersons and Back to the Future and Clue and The Gods Must Be Crazy. And so I had all these great ideas, and so we find them online and purchase them legally. We don't download them illegally. And we get these movies and we watch them. And as I'm watching them, I'm horrified as a dad going, Susie, I'm sorry, I didn't know that was in there. Boys, close your eyes. Tucker, don't ask what that word means, please. That I'm approaching these eyes with a new lens. I'm approaching these movies with new eyes and a new lens that's making me rethink how I envision or see these movies again. And as we think about how we respond to what Jesus teaches, I just ask you to maybe throw on a new pair of lenses as we look at these. Because I think if we're honest, there's two reactions that we often have when we read this section of the Sermon on the Mount. The first one is legislation. Now, that may not make enough sense, so let me explain it for a second. Last week, I listened to Doug's sermon online. Again, I wasn't here, so I listened to it Sunday evening on the way home from the beach. And Doug talked about the Jesus fulfilling the law but not abolishing the law. And he said there's two traps we can get into, legalism and lazyism. And I agree. I like the hyphen in lazy. That looks better. But legalism and lazyism. And a legalist is thinking through how they can fulfill the law and how they can make themselves righteous. And the lazyism, that's somebody who's going, Jesus has it covered, so I'm okay. I'll just live any way I want to live. And these two traps that we get into. And I think the same trap holds true when we read this, that we can read through the Sermon on the Mount and go, I'll just legislate more boxes in my life. I'll just create more rules for me to follow. I love a to-do list. I'll just check them all off. You want to add more, Jesus? Go ahead, add more. And we start adding more things to do, and we just tell ourselves, we'll try harder, we'll be better, we'll work better, and that will make me righteous, and I'll make it happen because I can legislate this into my life. Jesus says, that's not it. But see, I think the other honest reaction we can have is one of resignation. We can read through these teachings of Jesus and go, obviously Jesus doesn't mean that we actually have to live that way. That he's setting the bar so high that he doesn't expect any of us to get there. He just wanted to communicate that we all need him. We all need grace, and so I'll just take grace and live the way I want to live. I'm not going to shoot for this at all. But I don't think resigning ourselves to a life not meeting this mark is what Jesus wants either. In fact, I read these texts, and the word that comes to mind for me is transformation. Transformation. That Jesus can transform us and enable us to live this way. But how do we do that? It means we circle back to the Beatitudes. I think we're going to be doing that a lot as we read through the Sermon on the Mount. That in Matthew 5, verse 2, Jesus begins his teaching. And the Beatitudes, we've told you this whole series, write them out, type them out, print them off, memorize them, put them in your journal, put them in your Bible, put them on the wall, because this is the path to transformation. Jesus starts in verse 2 or verse 3 and he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I read the Beatitudes and I go, "Jesus, I can't. There's no way I can live that way. I'm poor in spirit." Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." We acknowledge what our sin has done in the world around us. I still see Hudson holding that fishing pole with broken line and the look on his face when I killed him with my words. Now, I don't have to mourn forever because Jesus says we will be comforted. Then he said, "Blessed are the meek," because we come to Jesus going, "I am powerless to live this way without you." And the good news is Jesus says, "Yeah, that's great, because I'm not confined to the Holy of Holies. So you want to tap into my power. I am with you, and I will live in you and through you and enable you to start living the way that I want you to live." You've heard it said, but I say, Creator of the universe, the creator of us, the creator of this law, the one whose character is embedded in it, says, don't react the way you always have to what I've said. Don't just legislate morality in your lives, and please don't resign to the fact that you'll never be this, because I am with you, and if you will come to me poor in spirit, mourning your sin, seeking righteousness that comes from me alone, then I will fill you and be with you and transform you into what I created you to be. May we read Jesus' words this morning, seek to be transformed. I asked Tommy to come up and sing a song, or lead us all in a song this morning. It's a song that I started singing probably when I was 5 or 6 years old. It's a simple song. It says, "In my life, Lord, be glorified." May we ask Jesus to transform us so that we can glorify him, so that we can live transformed. May this song this morning become our prayer.